This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, the new year doesn't require a new you. Maybe just a less burdened you. And therapy can help more easily identify what weighs you down, holds you back, by offering an unbiased perspective to better understand your relationships, motivations, and emotions. And that's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp offers quality therapists. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. They also offer a therapist match commitment. BetterHelp does the initial matching for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps you identify your needs and preferences, and 12 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means BetterHelp typically get it right the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from the Tailored Recs. Look, if you're listening to this show, then you get us. We are all the morbid curious, and we can all use a little bit of help every now and then. And I've found that help through therapy, and I hope that you can too. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's better, H-E-L-P.com. 2026 is the year you launch your business. The year you transform into an entrepreneur, founder, a boss. You all just saw videos of Troy moving into his American Oddities Museum in a new spot in downtown Alton because we are always hustling to do better, and so can you. One powerful move puts your future firmly in your hands, starting a business with Shopify. Maybe you've got an idea you can't shake, a craft everyone tells you to sell, a store you've already designed in your head. With Shopify, 2026 is when you finally make it happen. Shopify gives you everything you need to sell online and in person. Millions of entrepreneurs have already made this leap, from household names to first-time business owners just getting started. Shopify gives you all the tools to easily build your dream store. Choose from hundreds of beautiful templates that you can customize to match your brand. Setup is fast with Shopify's built-in AI tools that write product descriptions and headlines and help you edit product photos. Marketing is built in too. Create email and social campaigns that reach customers wherever they scroll. As you grow, Shopify grows with you. Handle more orders, expand to new markets, and do it all from the same dashboard. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Shopify powers our American Honey's clothing store, as well as multiple other side projects that you all know me for. In 2026, stop waiting and start selling with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. That's shopify.com/hauntings. Hear your first this new year with Shopify by your side.
No one was expecting much from the awkward, skinny young man who climbed up on the juke joint stage and sat down in the solitary chair with a guitar in his hand. A few of the audience members recognized him. Just 6 months before, he'd been booed off this very stage. They laughed, ready to shame the young man so badly he wouldn't try this again. But then he began to play. One hand flashed up and down the neck of the guitar, while the other conjured up spooky riffs and moaning slide guitar lines that accompanied a voice that seemed to know the pain of the blues. And after that night, the whispers began. They soon repeated a legend that was told and retold over and over again. They said the young man, whose name was Robert Johnson, had sold his soul to the devil at a crossroads at Mississippi's Highway 61 at midnight. He'd sold it in exchange for some sinister guitar skills and a handful of tunes. He also got an escape from the poverty into which he'd been born, and with that came the adoring company of women, whiskey, fortune, and fame. His infamy quickly grew, but at night Robert was haunted by dreams in which the devil pursued him down a long dirt road leading to a graveyard. They were nightmares that inspired songs that made him even more famous, like Me and the Devil Blues, Hellhound on My Trail, and, of course, Crossroads Blues. The legend goes on to say that the devil only allowed Robert to live until his 27th birthday. He was apparently poisoned by a club owner who suspected the singer of seducing his wife. He was buried in an unmarked grave by the locals who refused to put him in consecrated ground for fear that the devil would come to claim his own. But what part of this story is true and what part is simply imagination? Well, as with any legend, it's hard to separate the fact from the fiction in Robert Johnson's life. He was probably born on May 11, 1911, in Hazelhurst, Mississippi, the result of an affair between his mother, Julianne Majors, and a farm worker named Noah Johnson. By 1927, Robert was working in the cotton fields and was married twice. His first wife, Virginia Travis, died in childbirth in 1930. Death claimed both mother and child. Around the time that he started to play music, he married Callie Craft. Robert's first musical instrument was a harmonica, but he later switched to guitar, but he couldn't do much with it. Local blues legends like Willie Brown, Son House, and Charlie Patton often let Robert sit in with them when they played the roadhouses, but they weren't impressed with his playing, and they tended to avoid him when they weren't on stage. Audiences were equally unimpressed, and his solo acts were often greeted with laughter and heckling from the crowd. And then Robert disappeared for 6 months. Some say that he went in search of his natural father, while others say it was during this time that Robert, carrying a black cat's bone, went down to the crossroads and made a bargain with the devil. It was said that when he returned to the roadhouses, the older blues players were amazed by his new mastery of the guitar. According to legend, it was Son House who stated, quote, "He sold his soul to play like that." Robert's guitar instructor was said to be a man named Ike Zimmerman, a peculiar name for a blues man, since all the great performers had legendary monikers like Blind Lemon Jefferson, Sonny Boy Williamson, Muddy Waters, and Howlin' Wolf. Even stranger than his name was the way he taught Robert to play. He claimed to have learned guitar at night, sitting in old country churchyards with the dead as his only companions. Some claimed Zimmerman was the devil himself, and most of the local bluesmen had no problem accepting that claim as fact. It's no surprise that whispers of a devilish deal followed Robert wherever he went. But Robert wasn't the first bluesman said to have sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads. There were already stories about another early blues player named Tommy Johnson, no relation to Robert, who had waited at a lonely crossroads to make his own deal with the devil. Stories claim that if a man wanted to learn to play, he should take his guitar to the crossroads at midnight and wait, and then a big man would walk up to him, take his guitar, and tune it. And after that, the deal was struck. The crossroads had a long connection to the supernatural. They were the final resting place for suicides and those unworthy of being buried in hollow ground. The crossroads were the site where witches held their gatherings. African Americans knew about the guardian of the crossroads, Papa Legba, who had traveled across the ocean with the first slaves. Many claimed he was the big man who appeared to those who came looking for a deal, while others swore it was the devil himself. But no matter what they believed, they all spoke in hushed tones about conjurers, spells, and gree-gree bags, and many of them had likely paid someone for a good luck charm or for help to ward off evil. They knew about mojo hands and charms made from graveyard dust, St. John the Conqueror root and black cat bone, which would help the owner find love, fame, and fortune. Having such a bone allowed a person to cast spells and perhaps, in the case of Robert Johnson, summon up the devil. Well, if the story was true, it worked. After Robert began to achieve fame as a blues man, he began traveling the South, rambling from town to town, jumping freight trains and landing in small towns with roadhouses that gladly offered him the stage. In 1936, at the insistence of a Jackson, Mississippi music store owner, Robert began a short recording career with a salesman from Columbia Records. Within 1 year, he'd recorded each of his now legendary songs with primitive equipment in dusty hotel rooms. In return for the recordings, he was only paid about $100, but the records were not how he achieved his fame during his lifetime. That was by playing the blues on stage. Robert's reputation packed the juke joints in which he performed. He had a cataract in one eye that many superstitious followers claimed was an evil eye that sent someone straight to hell. Some of the local musicians noticed that Robert turned his back to the audience when he performed. They believed he was hiding the fact that the devil helped him pluck his chords. In truth, though, he was hiding his guitar licks from the other players. He wanted to keep his techniques a closely guarded secret. He also experimented with open tunings, which is when a bass chord is played open and all similar chords in the chromatic scale are then played by barring all strings across a single fret. An unknown idea at the time, but now a common technique in blues playing. Robert spent his last years traveling around the Delta and to other parts of the country, including Memphis, St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, New York, and even Canada. He went from one roadhouse to another, never settling in one place, although he did have a home in Helena, Arkansas for a time. Late in 1938, impresario John Hammond planned to present Robert at Carnegie Hall, an appearance that would have undoubtedly made him a national star. But unfortunately, Robert died before that could happen. It should be no surprise that the circumstances of Robert's death are a mystery. Though it's evident he was murdered, there are many versions about his demise. Some say that he was stabbed or shot to death by a jealous girlfriend or one of his many lovers' angry spouses or boyfriends. It's also claimed he was poisoned by a jealous husband while performing at a Mississippi roadhouse one night. Johnny Shines and other musicians claim that Robert died after 3 days of intense, excruciating pain on August 16th. 1938. The legend claims that Robert's family buried him in an unmarked grave and in unhallowed ground, but if that's true, it's hard to explain why there are three different graves for him in three different cemeteries, each claiming to be the real one. Which story is true? Well, no one knows for sure. But what if he's not buried in any of them? Maybe the devil came to get Robert Johnson on that dark night in August and carried his body away with him because, well, you know what they say about the afterlife and all the musicians who died too young. Wherever they ended up, it's a place that has a hell of a band. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror with true accounts of diabolical witches, murderous madmen, haunted houses, death and dying, and stories of revenge and despair that have been torn from the pages of our haunted past. As you're aware from previous episodes, we're beginning our journey back in time with the mysterious figure that serves as the source of so much of America's fear, the devil himself. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor, that's me, and thanks for joining me for Episode 8, Down at the Crossroads. As we've already discussed in past episodes, America's first settlers were afraid of a lot of things. And when they were afraid of something, they reflexively connected it to the devil, whether it was places like forests and woods or people like the Native Americans who had predated their arrival on these shores by hundreds of years. In other words, whatever they didn't understand, they feared. And whatever they feared, well, it must be the work of the devil. And it wasn't just the indigenous people they feared and disliked. It was also the Africans. Small groups of them began arriving in the British colonies as early as 1619. They weren't immigrants, though. They'd been kidnapped from their homeland and transported to America against their will. Their numbers grew at a gradual pace throughout the 17th century before increasing dramatically in the century that followed. Nearly every African in America at the time was held in bondage by white settlers, who, while perhaps not terrified by the slaves themselves, were terrified by their persistence in upholding the traditions and beliefs they brought to the country with them. Back at home, magical practices had been central to the supernatural beliefs of the slaves. When they were brought to America in chains, their beliefs may have changed somewhat, but they still included a legion of spirits who influenced their daily lives. And not all those spirits were benevolent ones, especially toward the white slave owners. Evidence of this came directly from the writings of the white colonists. Many documents of the era referred to conjurers and poison doctors among the slave population. They made frequent reference also to specific kinds of magic, charms, invocations, and substances like powders and roots. A different kind of evidence comes from under the ground. Archaeologists have recovered artifacts of African-American magic, like amulets, beads, objects made of glass, ceramic, wood, and bone. And words survive as well, like juju, a word for evil spirit, or mojo, which we'll come back to in a minute. Taken together, these things combine to reveal a distinct African presence in America, especially in the southern colonies, where slavery spread the fastest after 1700. And fear spread with it. Slave owners and other white settlers were terrified of sorcery being practiced by slaves. Most of all, they feared poisoning, a word that had multiple meanings in the documents and diaries of the time. In some cases, it described the ingestion of a lethal substance, but in others, it referred to a supernatural power, poisoning by way of spirits or diabolical magic. Dozens, if not hundreds, of slaves were suspected, accused, convicted, and put to death for alleged acts of poisoning. Accusations of witchcraft had always targeted the most marginalized members of every community, which turned enslaved people into obvious targets. In 1705, a Virginia couple, Luke and Elizabeth Hill, accused a slave named Grace Sherwood of witchcraft. Although the courts found little of this at first, the always reliable search for the devil's mark on the woman's body found proof of her interactions with the evil one. Grace next underwent the infamous water test, which involved her being thrown into the water to see if she floated or sank. And since she didn't drown, she was charged and went on trial. Although the record ends at this point, and her fate remains unknown. Even the American Revolution failed to completely put an end to the witch trials. In 1779, in the territory that would eventually be Illinois, there were still many French settlers who owned slaves. Authorities in Cahokia executed several dozen slaves after being tried and convicted for witchcraft and poisoning. Most were reportedly shot and then burned, but one slave, a man named Moreau, was hanged. Colonel John Todd, the commander of the Illinois settlements under the Commonwealth of Virginia, wrote that Moreau had been executed because, quote, he poisoned his master, but his mistress was too strong for his necromancy. White slave owners were terrified, and they had good reason to be. The magical practices of America's enslaved people commonly became known as hoodoo. It's a belief in a form of folk magic, conjuring, and root work, and it's not to be confused with voodoo, although it shares some things. Voodoo is a religion. Hoodoo is not. It began with the conversion of many Africans to Christianity, which was then mixed with traditions carried from home. The people also learned regional botanical knowledge from Native Americans and from white immigrants who settled in the mountain regions of the South, combining into what has been called hoodoo. Or in the parlance of many white Southerners, especially slave owners, it was called the devil's work. You see, Southern plantation owners loved to justify the institution of slavery by citing verses from the Bible that allowed it. When the people they own resisted against it, they were accused of acting against God's will. In other words, doing the work of the devil. Hoodoo as a resistance movement in America began as early as 1712, when a slave revolt occurred in New York, led by a conjurer named Peter the Doctor. He mixed a magical powder that contained graveyard dirt, which conjured up the ancestors of the slaves for help, and instructed the slaves to rub it on their bodies and clothing for protection. In the 19th century, hoodoo became its own form of resistance against slavery. It was done one way by leaving magical symbols in plain sight around the owner's property. Another way was through mojo bags. These small leather or cloth bags were filled with herbs, bones, and other magical items and were often referred to as gree-gree, bags of tricks, or most commonly, mojo bags. The term mojo appears in the lyrics of many traditional blues songs. In the songs, though, the lyrics are misinterpreted to mean that mojo has something to do with sexual prowess. A trick bag becomes a metaphor for bad behavior, but that wasn't the original use of the term. Mojo bags served as amulets for good luck, finding love, and providing protection. They were meant to be always kept on your body. If someone stole your mojo, it wasn't for any reason in a blues song. It was because the mojo carried your personal power, and its loss could be dangerous or even fatal when it ended up in the wrong hands. Slaves used the mojo bags as a symbol of their resistance. They were instructed to gather roots and herbs into the bags and then march around their cabins and point the bags toward the master's house every morning. Those who'd been mistreated would remarkably find their situation would quickly improve. One account tells the story of a slave who went to a conjurer to get a charm that would prevent him from being beaten and whipped. He was given a powder to sprinkle around the owner's bed and to place in the man's shoes. Many slave narratives document the use of graveyard dirt to escape from slavery. They would rub the dirt on their feet and leave it on the trail behind them to keep the slave catcher's dogs from picking up their scent. Even if the magic bags, symbols, charms, and graveyard dirt really didn't do anything, just the threat of them convinced white slave owners that something terrible might befall them. And that was a fear that turned out to be justified. An unknown mixture of powders called goopher dust was created that could be mixed into the master's food to prevent cruel treatment. Prevented how, you might ask? Well, by killing the master. Goopher dust was a deadly poison. Another story told of an enslaved woman known only as Old Julie. She had a reputation among the slaves on the plantation where she lived for being able to conjure death. Rumors of her fatal spells spread so widely that her owner eventually sold her to keep her from killing anyone else. She was placed on a steamboat that would take her to her new owner, but according to the stories, Old Julie used her powers to turn the boat around and force the original owner to cancel the sale and keep her with her family. Hoodoo conjurers were such a threat to southern slave owners, they eventually outlawed any kind of magical practice, but it was almost impossible to stop. There's no record of how many slave owners lived in fear of magic during the 19th century South, or how many died from being poisoned by conjurers, but the number's probably pretty high. Although, of course, this was seen by the unsympathetic as the price you pay for keeping another man in chains. Once slavery finally ended after the Civil War, hoodoo spread throughout the United States as African Americans left the South during a time that became known as the Great Migration. Just as Delta blues singers went north to Memphis, St. Louis, and Chicago and traded their acoustic guitars for electric ones, people took hoodoo with them to communities in the North. Conjuring became essential for many believers who were looking for money, employment, and protection during the Jim Crow era in the United States. They needed jobs to support their families and protection from the unjust laws that segregated the country. But when they came north, their rituals had to be modified because there was no place to gather roots and herbs in nature. They had to buy them in neighborhood stores that sold botanicals, most of which were owned by white people and who now had a brand new customer base. They opened new locations in African American communities and began offering items both requested by their customers and things they thought would be useful. They stocked herbs and powders and roots along with wax candles in glass jars labeled for things like fast luck or love drawing. Hoodoo also became important to those who played the policy numbers each week. These were illegal lotteries in which players picked numbers to bet on. Hoodoo offered luck candles, oils, tokens, mojo bags, and dream books, which promised lucky numbers for every day of the year. Between policy promoters, white pharmacists, and white-owned mail-order companies, the culture of hoodoo drastically changed in the early 20th century, and it became something else altogether different. It became marketed, commercialized, and sometimes fabricated. For example, in African American folk stories, High John the Conqueror was an enslaved black man whose spirit resides in a root that was commonly used in magic. But drugstore owners began putting an image of a white man on their High John the Conqueror root labels. And as a result, many African Americans eventually forgot that John had started out as a black man. They also introduced a magical book called the Sixth and Seventh Book of Moses into hoodoo tradition. It was quickly accepted because African Americans connected with the story of Moses freeing the Israelite slaves from Egypt. They were also impressed by the magic Moses used against the Egyptians, and he was soon being referred to as, quote, the finest hoodoo man in the world. Even though hoodoo was commercialized in the first half of the 20th century, there's no doubt it was still taken very seriously by those who faithfully practiced it. And while many who discovered hoodoo came to it looking for love, luck, and protection, there's always been an undercurrent of danger to it, largely thanks to how it began as a way to threaten those who mistreated the people who believed in it. But death wasn't always caused by voodoo. Sometimes it happened because of hoodoo. And that's what likely occurred in the story of a hoodoo-related murder that happened in 1929. Of course, we'll never know that for sure because to this day, this bloody and violent massacre has never been solved. On July 3, 1929, police officers entered a house on St. Aubyn Street in Detroit, Michigan. Inside, they found a man named Benny Evangelist seated behind his desk. His hands were neatly folded in his lap, as though he was in prayer. His head, though, was at his feet, lying on the floor. Upstairs, they found his wife, Santina, and their children, Mario, who was 18 months old, Angelina, age 7, Margaret, age 5, and Jean, age 4. Santina was on the bed with baby Mario. She had also been beheaded, and Mario's skull was crushed. Across the hall, the other children had been slaughtered in their beds. The story of the Evangelist murders is one of the strangest stories in American crime. It's a dark tale of hoodoo, murder, and a clever and enterprising man who came to Detroit with big plans and used the opportunities he found in a city that was then bursting at the seams. It was that time of great migration, when African Americans from the rural South flocked to northern cities in search of work and hoping to escape the racist laws back home. It was also a time when immigrants from all over the world were settling in those same cities with the same dreams of prosperity and freedom. Sadly, both of those groups found their slice of the American dream working in factories doing backbreaking labor and living in overcrowded tenement buildings and ramshackle homes. They'd come to Detroit hoping for a better life, but the future still seemed just out of reach. But all hope wasn't lost. There was always someone who could offer something better, a pathway to a brighter existence, a little love, a little luck, and some good fortune for a price. one of those best known for offering such things in Detroit's black and immigrant neighborhoods, was Benny Evangelist. And that may have been what got him killed. Born in Naples, Italy in 1885, Benjamino Evangelista came to America in 1904 and settled in Philadelphia with his brother, Antonio. But the two eventually had a falling out. By his own account, Antonio disowned Benjamino when he began dabbling in hoodoo and magic, which was very much against their strict Catholic upbringing. Benjamino moved to York, Pennsylvania, and started a job for a railroad construction crew. One of the friends he made on the crew was a fellow immigrant from Naples named Aurelius Angelino. He began to share Benjamino's passion for magic, and the two began dabbling in spells and hexes. One day, though, something snapped in Aurelius, and in 1919, he attacked his own family with an axe and killed two of his children. He was sent to a prison for the criminally insane, and Benjamino, unsettled by what had occurred, moved west to the bustling city of Detroit. He found work as a carpenter, married another Italian immigrant, and invested his savings in real estate, soon becoming a prosperous realtor and landlord. With his newfound success, he decided to change his name and began calling himself Benny Evangelist, dropping the vowels from the ends of his name to Americanize them, a common thing for immigrants at the time. On the side, he supplemented his income with a drugstore that sold hoodoo remedies, hexes, herbs, and roots. He had many clients and earned a lot of money with the tricks he sold to them. He performed rituals and psychic healings for fees that sometimes were as high as $10, which was equal to 2 days of pay on a factory assembly line. But his clients happily paid it. And soon he was making as much money selling love spells and hexes to his African-American customers and protection from the evil eye to the immigrant ones as he was with his real estate deals. His clients began calling him the, quote, Hex Doctor of Detroit. Doing so well for himself, Benny purchased a house at the corner of St. Aubin and Mack Avenues and moved his wife and children into it. It was a large, comfortable home, the nicest in the neighborhood. It was painted green and had a wide front porch. Benny began meeting many clients there, escorting them down to the basement where he kept all of his conjuring tools. It was said that someone passing by the house could catch a glimpse through one of the basement windows and see what Benny called his Great Celestial Planet Exhibition, which was hanging from the ceiling. It was a papier-mâché, wire, and wood model of the solar system. The sun was represented by an electric eye in the center of the model. The rest of Benny's conjure kitchen wasn't as easy to see. There he mixed up his potions and spells, wrote down hexes, and sewed together mojo bags. The shelves around his work table were filled with jars that contained herbs and roots and dirt, dried animal parts, and anything else he might need. An assortment of knives and daggers was hanging on a wall rack within easy reach. Copies of Benny's self-published book, which had the very catchy title of The Oldest History of the World Discovered by Occult Science in Detroit, Michigan, were stacked around the room. Benny claimed to have produced the book by going into nightly trances. He planned for it to be a first in a series of four books that would reveal previously unknown information relayed to him by God. But of course, the series would never be finished. God or fate or someone had other plans for Benny Evangelist. On the bright and sunny morning of July 3rd, a client of Benny's named Vincent Elias arrived at his house on St. Aubin Street. He'd made an appointment to meet Benny that morning, so it seemed strange to him when no one answered when he rang the bell. But then Vincent noticed that the door was cracked open an inch or so. And he saw the smear of what looked like blood on the doorknob. Fearing something terrible may have happened, he pushed the door open and went inside. He only got as far as Benny's office, located next to the parlor, before he saw the headless body of Benny Evangelist sitting in a chair behind the desk. That was enough for Vincent. He fled the house in terror and immediately notified the police. Officers were soon on the scene, including most of Detroit's homicide detectives. Word had spread about the gruesome discovery in the house, and everyone, including many of the neighbors, wanted a look. They'd started gathering outside when the detectives arrived to search the place, making notes that were featured in newspaper reports later that day. In addition to Benny's headless body, another strange discovery was made in his office. Surrounding his severed head were three framed photographs of a deceased child in a coffin. The edges of the picture frames were soaked with blood. The dead child was later determined to be Benny's son, who'd passed away several years before. There was no explanation as to what message the photographs were supposed to send. According to one newspaper article, quote, "Several pieces of women's undergarments, each tagged with the name of its owner, police point out, revealed the so-called mystic indulged in practices of voodooism or devil worship. Such garments, voodooism has it, can lead to finding a missing person when they're properly handled by one versed in the mystical arts of that belief." While untrue, the police had little knowledge to work with. The discovery of women's undergarments, along with all the workings that Benny kept in his basement, certainly seemed strange and exotic to white police detectives, newspaper reporters, and most of the paper's readers. However, they were likely used for love spells that Benny was making for his clients. In the 1920s, though, voodooism or devil worship was a term to imply that the victims had either been African American or immigrants. It wasn't long before rumors spread that Benny's hoodoo business was responsible for the murders of the family. Unfortunately, the crime scene was poorly secured by the police. They failed to keep out the reporters and the morbidly curious neighbors, and they quickly contaminated the scene, gawking at the bodies, picking up souvenirs, and probably destroying a lot of clues. Only one clue managed to survive the invasion, the bloody fingerprint on the front doorknob. Detectives believed it had been made by a thumb. It was well preserved, though, and if a suspect were found and could be matched to the print, they'd have their killer. More problems arose when detectives canvassed the neighborhood and tried to get assistance from the Evangelist family's neighbors. Most were Italian immigrants who had no interest in providing information to the police. Detectives encountered the same problem when interviewing those on Benny's client list. His African-American customers, they wouldn't talk to the police either. Benny's records proved that hundreds of people had come to him for his services, but only a handful of those on the list would even admit they knew him, and even fewer still offered anything useful to detectives. The police used what little information they had to form three very different theories about the massacre. One of them involved some threatening letters Benny had in his desk that suggested he had once crossed paths with the Black Hand, a loose criminal group known for extorting wealthy Italian immigrants. The most recent letter, though, was over 6 months old, and it warned, "This is your last chance." The problem with the Black Hand theory was, though, by 1929, it was an outdated, defunct enterprise that had long since evolved into organized crime. Crude extortion schemes were a thing of the past, dating back to the years before Prohibition, which turned common criminals into bootleggers who amassed their own wealth. It's unlikely that Benny took the note seriously. It never said explicitly that it came from the Black Hand, and whoever had written the crude misspelled letter had likely been an amateur looking for an easy score. It probably wasn't someone who would have carried out the grisly murders of an entire family. The second theory suggested that someone from Benny's past may have killed the family. Notably, his old friend, Aurelius Angelo, who had attacked his own family and killed two of his children years before. Aurelius had been sent to a hospital for the criminally insane, but in 1923, he'd escaped and was never seen again. Could he have traveled to Detroit looking for revenge against Benny? Maybe. The third theory seemed the most plausible to the cops. One of Benny's clients was a 42-year-old man named Umberto Tecchio, and he had visited the evangelist's home on the night of the murders. That was no secret. Tecchio had owed money to Benny for a hex he'd made for him and had stopped by the house with a friend, Angelo DiPoli, to pay the bill. The police brought both men in for questioning on July 5th after an axe, a knife, and a pair of suspiciously clean work boots were found in the barn behind the boarding house where Tecchio lived. The two men claimed to know nothing about the murders. They stated that nothing unusual had occurred during their brief visit. After Benny was given his money, they went out drinking. Tecchio said he hadn't even thought about Benny again until he saw the story about the murders in the newspapers. But the fact that two Italians had been brought in for questioning was something the newspapers could sensationalize. Stoking prejudice against immigrants, reporters started digging and brought up the fact that just 3 months earlier, Tecchio had stabbed his brother-in-law to death during an argument. He'd been released when it was judged to be self-defense, but this was enough to turn him into the prime suspect for the murders. But when his fingerprints were compared to the print left behind on the doorknob, the police were forced to let him go. The thumbprint didn't match Tecchio or his friend. Tecchio died a few years later in 1934. And with that, the investigation began to grow cold, and it eventually fizzled out altogether. There was nowhere left to go without witness statements and physical evidence, and the murders, thanks to this, remain unsolved to this day. Looking back at this crime, after all these years, only two answers might fit what happened. The first was that Aurelius Angelino murdered Benny and his family. This was a man who'd slaughtered his children while attempting to kill his entire family, much like what happened at the evangelist home. It wouldn't be impossible for him to have made his way west to Detroit from Pennsylvania and to have tracked down a man who'd made quite a name for himself in the immigrant community. Perhaps he'd come looking for an old friend who he believed could help him to make a new life for himself. And maybe he found Benny and was turned away for one of several reasons, fear, disgust, or even disinterest. Perhaps Aurelius looked around Benny's luxurious home and saw how happy he was with his wife, his children, and his prosperous business and became enraged. He thought about the horrors he'd endured over the last 9 years and felt anger boil up inside of him. It isn't hard to imagine the escaped madman slithering in an open window while Benny sat at his desk during the early morning hours of July 3rd, or better yet, just coming in right through the front door, leaving that thumbprint behind. And once inside the house, how difficult would it have been for him to murder the family of the man who left him behind to rot in the insane asylum while he practiced his magic and grew rich selling potions and spells? Yeah, it's not hard to imagine that at all. And yet, after Angelino's escape from the state of Pennsylvania's custody in 1923, no record of his existence was found in Detroit or anywhere else. Could a family of six be slaughtered so easily and the killer simply disappear? Well, it's certainly possible, as history has proven time and time again. But it's also possible that a disgruntled client of Benny's murdered the evangelists. Hundreds of people had come to him during his years in Detroit looking for hexes, potions, and cures. And this also meant there were a lot of people in the city who might have been victims of the hexes and curses that Benny had created for his clients. Maybe someone's life had been ruined by a trick that Benny had conjured, or maybe it was as simple as an unhinged man who'd come to Benny for a love spell and then had been denied by the object of his intentions. Would those people have sought out such an extreme act of revenge? It's impossible to know what anyone would or wouldn't do under the right circumstances. Again, the blood-stained pages of history certainly prove this to be the case. In the end, though, not sure it matters. The murder of the evangelist family was never solved. All we know for sure is that someone entered the house on St. Albans Street that night, exacted some sort of punishment on its inhabitants, and then vanished into the hot July night, leaving a bloody thumbprint on a doorknob. It's a murder that will likely never be solved. Thanks for listening to the latest episode, and I hope you'll stay with me for just a few more minutes to hear some of the latest news and announcements from American Nightmares. See, we've got two pieces of big news. The first is, of course, that tickets go on sale for the 2026 Haunted America Conference on this coming Monday, January 12th, a few days away. And I know what you're thinking. It's a big place. I'm sure there'll be lots of tickets. And you're right. General admission tickets for the weekend won't sell out quickly, but you know what will? All those after-hours events that we also offer, so that when you're coming to town for the conference, you can get a full weekend out of it. This year's after-hour events will include a downtown Alton haunted pub crawl, campfire ghost stories, dowsing in past lives, regressions, workshops, Estes method experiments, Alton hauntings walking and bus tours, black mirror scrying, a magical gallery experience with the three Appalachian witches, an ITC Beyond the Static workshop, at least 8 ghost hunts, and a whole lot more. This is going to be our biggest and best year so far, and you can get all the details now at the website at ghostconference.net. So just return to the website or watch for newsletters or Facebook posts on Monday so you can get signed up, because you don't want to miss out on anything. And finally, here's the other thing. Mark your calendar for January 17th. That's next week. We'll be holding our grand reopening celebration at the new location of the American Oddities Museum. Our first event will be held the following weekend in Alton Seance, followed by our first dinner, The Devil Came to St. Louis, on January 31st. Things are really coming together at the museum, and I'll be posting some photos and videos in the next week or so. But come by on January 17th. Check the place out. And with that, I'll say thanks for coming back for another episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If you like the show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows in the network and recommend them to friends, family, people you work with, and anyone you think would love them too. If you do have thoughts or comments about American Nightmares, leave us a review or text your comments to the Haunt Line at 217-791-7859. As a thank you for being a listener, we've got a discount code that's just one word, podcast. And that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store. Just stick it in the slot where it asks for a promo code. And you'll find everything you could possibly want to know at AmericanHauntings.net. That website is home to our books, our tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and, of course, the American Oddities Museum. And while that makes American Hauntings sound big, we're really a small business that's grateful for all your support, because we couldn't and we wouldn't do all this without you. So thank you, and good night, good luck, and I'll see you next time. As long as the devil doesn't get you first.